You're all here tonight. We're going to get jump right in. We got a lot to cover. You probably already feel like you've been drinking water out of a fire hose a little bit, right? I mean, the last couple of days. I get that too. I work in Los Angeles County, and I, for the most part, just work cold case homicides. And these are things that never get solved. So let me go ahead and get our PowerPoint up on this wall here for you, and we'll just jump right into this. Okay. If you've watched Dateline, you'll see a lot of my cases. And these are just unsolved murders because there's no statute of limitations on a murder. That's why they stay open. So, you know, if you do a burglary or a robbery, well, those things are eventually going to close because there is a statute of limitations on those kinds of crimes. But on murder, these things just stay open. So that's why they're kind of fun to work, because they don't ever go away. So I had a bunch of cases that my dad had worked that I thought, I'm going to solve these cases and make him feel like an idiot. And I didn't solve any of them. But I solved a bunch of other cases. Does that count? We only end up solving one case for my dad. Now, my son is there now thinking, I want to solve a bunch of my dad's cases because I'll make him look like an idiot. And he has the same name I have because we're not creative with names. We just use the same name over and over and over again. And I used to give him, I gave him my uniforms when I left. I gave him all my uniforms because I had this name on them. So it was easy, right? Because I got my uniforms from guess who? From my dad, who had the same name. So we've been at the same agency with the same name for 59 years. And so for the most part, we just, you know, figure we'll use the name over and over again. And if you don't think that this dude right here is thinking to himself, I got to have a kid and I got to name him Jimmy and I got to figure out how to get him into law enforcement at this agency. I'm like, yeah, this is a lot of pressure. Too bad for you. But get started now. Anyway, a couple of years ago, I was asked to do like a 6-minute case for the truth of Christianity on a witness stand in a movie. And I thought, well, if I'm going to do this in 6 minutes, we need to know, is there any really good reason to believe this issue? They didn't ask me to get up and give my opinion. They asked me to get up and actually make a case for it. So you've been hearing people talk about this. Mike Lycona was here, was it yesterday, and talked about the reason why he believes, why we can be confident in the reliability of the New Testament. Okay. I want to do the same kind of thing, but I want to focus on a slightly different topic, and we're going to do it from a book that I wrote called Cold Case Christianity. I want to focus on what ends up being the most important single claim, evidential claim of Christianity. And we're just going to start and stay right in that topic tonight, okay? You know, in our town, when you get dispatched to a call because there's a dead person, those are called DBRs, dead body reports. And you get dispatched to DBRs when you get there, it's because somebody has died rather suspiciously. A couple of years ago, a couple of our officers got dispatched to a DBR. And at the DBR, there was a woman, and they recognized this woman's name and her address because they had worked her before. They had been involved. I had actually had a case with her. She was a bank robber. Weird, right? But she was a drug addict, a really committed drug addict, and she was now dead in her bed. So the officers get there, and they walk up on her bed, and this is her nightstand. Pretty interesting nightstand, right? This is probably like your nightstand, I'm sure. And if you look at it closely, you'll see that she's a heroin user. So she's got three heroin needles, one here, one here, one here. She's cooking on the bottom of that can. But because heroin will depress you and kind of make you non-responsive, she needed to function. So she would also smoke rock cocaine. So these are all of her cocaine pipes here. And that combination can be a nightmare. I remember when I arrested her for bank robbery, she would keep on falling asleep during the interview because she said, Jim, you got to let me hit my rock pipe so I can stay awake. Like, yeah, that's what's going to happen. That's not going to happen. And so I could never get an interview. And then I did this. I'm like, really? I could never get an interview out of her. And now here she is dead in her bed. What do you think the officers thought the cause of death was? Yeah. So they call the coroner's office out because in our agency, you call Los Angeles coroner's office to collect a dead body. And it takes forever for people to get there because we get like hundreds of dead bodies a day at the LA coroner's office. But about an hour and 15 minutes later, the coroner's investigator gets there and collects the body, pulls down the blankets, and sees that she's been stabbed to death. Yeah, officers are in the room kind of waiting for the investigator to get there, and they didn't even pull down the blankets. Well, why? Because they thought they knew the answer before they even rolled up on the place. Once they were dispatched, they're like, oh, eventually she was going to die. Here it is. Today's the day she overdosed. Then they get there, they see that nightstand, they're like, well, there you go. If you think you know the answer before you even start an investigation, oh, trust me. Number one, you're going to probably come to the wrong conclusion. Two, you're not even going to look for the right evidence. You're going to stop looking for evidence too early because you already think you know the answer. I just want to tell that story because We're really trying to get at what is true. Like, what is the most reasonable inference from evidence? And by the way, the standard of proof is not beyond a possible doubt, because I'd never convict anybody if it was beyond a possible doubt. I've never been able to answer every question for a jury. You have to learn how to render a verdict even though you have open questions. I've had cases where I don't even know how he killed her, when he killed her, what he did with her body. We never had a body. Where is her body now? Don't know. You gotta be able to render a verdict even though you can't answer the most significant questions in the case, because the standard is not beyond a possible doubt, it's beyond a reasonable doubt. That's a lower standard. Does that make sense? I don't even care about what's possible. I only care about what's reasonable, because that's the standard. But how do we know? How do we decide what's reasonable? I want to teach you that skill set tonight. Okay, let's start with the dead body. This body is a little less gruesome. Looks suspiciously like my son, Jimmy. Do you guys have Trader Joe's in Tucson? So you would never kill a Trader. I would never kill a Trader Joe's employee, because we would starve, okay? Because we buy everything from Trader Joe's. Now, a dead guy in a room is not always a murder. Lots of reasons why people die. There are four reasons why people die. Only one of them is a homicide. So how do I determine if this death scene is a crime scene? Well, I make two lists that begin with the letter E. First, I make a list of evidence, and I compare the evidence in the room with explanations for the evidence in the room. So far what I have something simple. I have a dead guy laying face down. How do you explain dead guys laying face down? There are four ways to explain them. Got any guesses? You can actually participate in this part. Just scream out what you think is, like, how do people die? There are four ways to die. Natural causes, a heart attack, that's right. So that would be one way, a natural. Anything else? Someone said if you trip or accidental, that's another way to die. Anything else? A murder is a way to die, but even before that, suicide is a way, and then you have homicides. Okay, so how do I know which of these four is the most reasonable explanation for the evidence in the room right now? Well, what can I cross out? Go ahead, yell it out. What can I cross out? Suicide? Well, if he intentionally took too many pills, he would look like this, wouldn't he? Heck, if I poisoned him with too many pills, he would look. If he accidentally took too many pills, if he just died of a heart attack, he would. I can't cross out anything right now. Let's change our scenario. What if he's a dead guy laying face down, but he's now in a pool of his own blood, center torso? Would that change things? Okay, so now I can add a piece of evidence to my list. Can I cross out anything? Yeah, I think I can cross out natural. Is it possible? Yes, anything is possible. But it's not reasonable. I'm not after possible, I'm after reasonable. Make sense? Look, he might bleed out from his nose or his mouth, but to bleed out from your center torso, like, how does that even, no, that's not, that's, I can probably rule out a natural. Can I cross out anything else? Not really, not until I roll him over and see what the injury is. Would you agree? So let's just leave it for now. Let's change the scenario. What if he's a dead guy laying face down in a pool of his own blood, but now he's got a big honking knife sticking out of his back? Would that change things? So let's put that on our evidence list. Okay. What can I cross out now? Well, I can't imagine how you could accidentally back up into that knife. Is it possible? Yeah, but it doesn't seem reasonable. You could accidentally back up into that knife in a vertical position. I think I can cross out accidental, but now you think, some people think I can cross out suicide too. Look, that's low enough. It's not in his high back, it's in his low back. Well, I mean, trust me, a lot of the suicides I go to are people who are high when they commit suicide. You see the craziest suicides. So I think I'm gonna leave that in for now. Let's change our scenario, though. What if we have a dead guy, he's laying face down, and he's got a knife in his back, that's not good. But he's also got multiple stab wounds in his upper back. That changes things, right? So now we can add that additional detail. Now, I think maybe he's got a super high, he's very flexible, and a high tolerance for pain. He's able to do that 100 times. I don't know. I think that's probably not reasonable, though. So I can probably cross out suicide. Now, for sure, if in addition to all this, we had bloody footprints leading out of the room, really hard to stab yourself multiple times in your own back and then walk out of the room in your own blood. Would you agree? That is probably going to be a homicide. Is it possible that it's not? Yes, of course. But this is the most reasonable inference from evidence. And by the way, this is Jimmy still alive, okay? We went to UCLA. I went to UCLA. Jimmy went to UCLA. So we're both Bruins. And my son David went to USC. And I always say, he's a communist, okay? Just so you know. That's the difference. So I just taught you a skill set that I talk about in Cold Case Christianity, which is known as abductive reasoning, or inferring to the most reasonable explanation. We do this at every death scene. We ask jurors to do this in every homicide trial. If you were impaneled on a jury for me, I'd be asking you to look at the explanations that I'm offering, the explanations the defense team is offering, and tell me, based on the evidence, which of these two explanations is most reasonable. That's what we do. Make sense? As a matter of fact, courtrooms are excellent laboratories for determining truth. And you learn a lot. We interview all of the jurors after trials to see what we did well, what we did wrong. What was it that persuaded you? What was unpersuasive? We're trying to figure this stuff out for the next jury trial. So this is called abductive reasoning. Now, at 35 years old, I was not a Christian. I wasn't raised in the church. I didn't know anybody who was a Christian. My wife would say to me, why didn't any of our friends ever talk about Jesus when we were kids? Like, no one ever invited us to church. Because it's really easy to live in Los Angeles County and not ever meet any Christians. You can find a way to do that. We did. So by the time we got to church, I was older and I knew how to do this, but I wasn't sure about Jesus. But I knew from what little I could get from scripture and I was willing to listen to, that there was an important piece of evidence that needed to be looked at, the resurrection. That this one piece of evidence was the critical piece of evidence in this worldview. And even Paul tells us this. Look, if this isn't true, not only do you have no hope of your own resurrection, but you're stupid enough to have been lied to. We are false witnesses and you bought it. So I thought, I'm just gonna focus on this. But how do I determine if the resurrection of Jesus, as described in the Gospels, is the most reasonable explanation from evidence? Well, it all comes down to what you would consider as evidence to begin with. And as an atheist, I would only have given you four things that I would have said, I agree to, but I still don't think Christianity is true, even though I would agree to these four things. So let's just give you that quick list. I would have said, yeah, I think that I'm not a Jesus myther. I think that Jesus lived. I think that he was crucified and buried. So what? This could be true, yet Christianity could be false. There are people today who die by way of crucifixion for their Christian beliefs. So what? That does not make Christianity true. So I would have said, yeah, I can give you that, but that doesn't mean it's true. I also would have said, well, you know, there's an empty tomb because in order to finish this in the first century, let me tell you how you would do it. Get the body of Jesus and drag it around town. Game over. Or get somebody who says they saw him alive to recant. Game over. So the fact, though, that didn't happen does not mean it's true. I can explain the empty tomb a number of different ways. So I would have given you these two things, but I would have still have said, yes, those two things can be true, but Christianity is still false. Make sense? The third thing I would have said is, okay, yeah, these people made a claim. They said they saw the risen Christ. People say, you work this job long enough, you'll realize that people say all kinds of stupid, crazy things that aren't true. So this wouldn't have impressed me either. And finally, I would say, okay, well, look, they seemed like they were committed to their beliefs. They were transformed by their beliefs. So what? People fly planes into buildings. They're committed to their beliefs. That's not true. All four of these things I would give you, but I would have still said Christianity is not true. And that's all I would have given you, nothing else. But think about it, if I'm gonna give you this much, I have to be able to explain to you how this could be true, yet Christianity could still be false, right? That's on me. I have to explain to you why. Well, I had some explanations in my pocket. I had like five or six explanations in my pocket. And I would have said one of these six things. The first six explanations on the wall here are the atheist explanations that I would have given you as a non-believer. The very bottom one is the Christian explanation. So if you're a Christian in this room, this is the one that you would tell me. I would have said you're wrong. But I thought at some point I owe it to myself to do what I do at death scenes. Go through my explanations. Which one is the best explanation for the evidence? And are there any deal-killing problems with these explanations that would cause me to move off of them? Well, I'm not gonna be able to go through all of these with you. I do this at Biola in a class. It takes me 17 hours to teach the class. Now, I can prove to you there's a God because we thought about just locking the doors and keeping you in here for the next 17 hours. But we didn't do that. Therefore, there is a God because that would be bad. So we've already proved that God exists. So now let's just move on to this resurrection stuff. Let's do a couple of these together, and then I'll send you the video tonight for all the rest, okay? Let's just do a couple together. Let's hop right in. First one, maybe they were just wrong. If Jesus isn't really dead on the cross, then he just looks dead. He's unconscious. Well, then we have a resuscitation, but not a resurrection. And that could be explained. That could explain a lot of stuff. So maybe he's just not dead. And I thought that from your scripture, there's good reason for me to believe that Jesus is not dead. Take a look right here in the Gospel of John. It says that he was executed along with two other people. When they came to collect the bodies, the two guys he was executed with, they weren't dead. They broke their legs to make sure they were dead. They didn't break Jesus' legs. I'm thinking all three are still alive. You didn't make sure Jesus was dead. All you do is poke him with a spear. Good job. So that's why he's not dead. Your own scripture seems to say he's not dead because you missed him. You didn't break his legs. But there's an interesting part of this passage that sticks out. And in early history, especially early Christian history, it was confusing to anyone who read it. And it's this bottom part here where it says that when they stabbed him in the chest, they saw a separation of blood and water. Now, I have to go to a lot of autopsies. So I get a chance to see some of this stuff. It's kind of interesting stuff. But the people who first read this were like, I don't get that blood and water thing. I don't even understand how that could be. As a matter of fact, the people who first read this would try to describe it in some other way. It couldn't have really been water. It must be a symbol of something else, a symbol of the baptism, a symbol of regeneration, a symbol of the Holy Spirit. It couldn't have been really water. And I don't care which church father you read, he will not describe this as real water. He'll describe this in some way as a symbol. Why? Because they're like trying to figure out how could water be separated from it. They didn't understand this piece of hidden science because the science on this wouldn't be available for about another 1,200 years. If you've ever been to a car accident and seen someone die in front, or you get to an assault, and it's just called an assault, you get there as an officer, and then the guy dies in front of you, you will see his body start to shut down, right? He'll go into circulatory shock. And the organs will try to reserve energy, reserve resources, and you'll start to see him become rather catatonic. If he suffers heart attack, some kind of cardiac arrest, at the end of that, he will suffer one of two kinds of effusion. Effusion is just when water collects. So for example, pericardial effusion is where the water builds up in a sac around your heart. But to be honest, it's not quite as fat as that. And number two, if you stab your heart, you're probably gonna nick the heart. That's a rich source of blood. This will not look like a separation of blood and water. It'll look like blood. But if you happen to be in the right position when you die, you'll suffer from what's called pleural effusion. That's different. Because your lungs are designed as a sac, and they will retain the water separate from the circulatory system. So if I stab your chest cavity, you will see a separation of blood and water. But this means you've already gone through cardiac arrest from circulatory shock. This separation of blood and water is a piece of hidden science that demonstrates he's already dead. And nobody caught it. Now, it might just be that John is so clever, he says, you know what? I'm going to include this little-known scientific fact here in the first century that no one's going to catch or even know anything about for another 1,200 years. And then when they finally figure out, they're going to go, wow, this dude, it's got to be true, right? I don't think he's doing that. I think he's just calling out what he observes. And it just happens to give us a clue. Now, a lot of you who are in this room are like, how many of you have touched dead bodies? Raise your hand. There's a few of us, right? Good. Most of us haven't touched dead bodies. And we think dead bodies are the stuff we see on TV. We think dead bodies are like unconscious actors laying very still. Dude, I'm telling you, that's not how they look. And you guys know if you touch a dead body. You can see a dead body across the room. I know that's a dead body. That's not somebody sleeping. And once you get up on them and touch them, you will know they're dead. Those of you who have touched dead bodies, is that true or false? Yeah. But because we don't know that in this generation, we think, oh yeah, he could be unconscious on the cross. Just unconscious. He's not really dead. Really? We call people to touch dead bodies. That's why we don't know the difference. We call coroners. We call mortuaries. If your grandma dies, you don't throw her over your shoulder and carry her down to the... No, you call someone to pick her up, right? So you never touched your dead grandmother. In the first century, there's no coroner to call. These people were their own midwives, and they were their own coroners and mortuaries. They wrapped their own dead. They were familiar with death in a way that we are not familiar in the 21st century. Does that make sense? So I want to make you familiar with death so you can see what I'm sure they saw. I'm going to take you downtown to Los Angeles. This is called North Mission Road. This is the Los Angeles County Coroner's Office. It's a wonderful old building. You walk up these steps, and it's no longer there. They closed it last year, but for years, and I'm so disappointed they closed it, you could walk up these steps, walk over here to the right, and behind this window right here was the Los Angeles County Coroner's gift shop. It was awesome. It was awesome, I'm telling you. It was called Skeletons in the Closet. You can Google it. They still have a landing page for that, but it's no longer there. And you can buy cool t-shirts like "Our bodies of work will speak for themselves." That's good. Or you can get a mouse pad that says "We're dying for your business." Now, if you go downstairs, and the next building over is the white building, that is the building where they have the examination rooms, and they're in the basement. And I will tell you that if you are assigned to a homicide in Los Angeles County, you have to be present at the autopsy because that coroner is not going to testify at the prelim. No, I'm going to testify for the coroner at the prelim. He costs a lot of money, and I don't. So I will be testifying for him. But that means I have to see everything that he sees so I can testify for him. So I have to go to a lot of autopsies. And they stink, literally and figuratively. So much so that I have one suit that would hang in the garage, which is the coroner office suit. Because once you go in that room, it stinks. I wish it looked like this, but it does not look like this. Well, maybe it looks like that the first day. But then you start doing, you know, hundreds of autopsies a year, and this gets to be a mess. It's never clean again. And when I started, those tables were wood. Yeah. Marine lacquer, but still, there's a reason why they're metal with these grooves so you can wash everything off those tables down into those grates right there. And no one even really does a very good job of it, so the room always smells like death. It's just a nasty place to be. And you know what? There's a sign on the back wall right behind this clipboard, and that sign says, "No eating in the examination room." Yeah. Like you're going to pop out a liver sandwich, right, and just munch on that liver sandwich. Now, if you go to autopsies, you recognize three inconvenient things about death that I think people in the first century would know, but we don't recognize them in the 21st century. And this is why I'm sure that pulling him off that cross, they would have seen these signs of death. They would not have mistaken a living Jesus who's unconscious for a dead Jesus. It's called the mortis triad. It's what happens when your heart stops beating. Three inconvenient truths. Here's what they are. The first thing that happens because you don't have hot blood coursing through your veins is you start to cool down. Your temperature drops. That loss of temperature is called algor mortis. So you know if you've handled dead people, they don't feel the same temperature as an unconscious living person, right? First thing you notice. Also, I've noticed as I get older that I don't have the elasticity I used to have where I could pinch the back of my wrist and let go and it snaps right back. Now it's like, oh yeah, I gotta kind of push it back. Right? Because this thing's changed with time. What's changing is the lack of blood circulating through your tissue. And so what you'll see is that people stiffen. And that stiffness is called rigor mortis. So if you die in an upright position, you're not just gonna flop down. Depending on how long you've been in that position, there's a window of stiffness, you get to kind of push your arms back down. The last thing that happens in the mortis triad is the one that's the most obvious and no one ever thinks about. And that is if your heart is not pushing blood, gravity will draw blood. So if you die on your back and I get there and I roll you over, your back will be discolored, purple, and swollen because the blood is now settled to your lowest region. If you die in an upright position, your feet will turn purple and swell. You won't miss this. But you never think about it. That is called liver mortis. I think that in the 21st century, we don't think about these things. We hired somebody else to do this. We don't do this ourselves. But in the first century, you do this yourself. You would have recognized. Now, is it possible they missed it? Sure. Anything is possible. I just don't think it's reasonable. And that's why I moved off the explanation. I think that hidden piece of science and plus the mortis triad was enough for me. Hey, but maybe they're just lying about it. Now, some of you love conspiracy theories. You love anything that has to do with the conspiracy. Like, raise your hand if you love conspiracy theories. I get it. Raise your hand. It's kind of a guilty pleasure. I get it. Raise your hand, okay? These are the stupid people in the room, okay? Just so you know. It is hard to pull off a conspiracy. Super hard. Okay, do we have any siblings in the room? Siblings? Brothers? Oh, all of you are siblings right there in that row? No. Now, siblings with each other in the room. Not that you have a sibling. So, do we have siblings in the room? Just the two of you? Okay, right here. Right, two sisters? Okay, do you have any other siblings? They're not here. How many do you have total? Five. Wow. That's pretty awesome, right? Five. Okay, I have six brothers and sisters, just so you know, my dad's second marriage. Six brothers and sisters, so I got you beat. But anyway, you got five. Are they all girls, all boys? What are they? One boy. One boy. The king and all those girls. Okay, get it. All right, so is that your parents sitting next to you? Oh, good. Are your parents here? Oh, don't let me teach you how to lie to your parents? No, I'm serious. I'll teach you how to lie to your parents right now. I'll teach you how to conspire together to lie to your parents. Take notes. You ready? Okay, here we go. It turns out that if you're going to lie, you have to have these five things in a conspiracy to be successful. If you think you know of a successful conspiracy, it wasn't successful by definition, right? The successful ones no one ever catches. So how do you pull those off? Is it possible? Yes, it's so hard though, but I'm gonna teach you how to do it. Okay, so here's the first thing you need. Pretty simple. This is not rocket surgery, for a mixed metaphor. This is just simple stuff. You need the smallest possible number of co-conspirators. You got five siblings. Okay, don't use all five. You want the smallest number of co-conspirators. You want to use just two. Just two of you is good enough, okay? First thing. Number two, you want to hold it for the shortest possible period of time. It's really much easier for two people to tell a lie than it is for 22, and it's much easier to tell a lie for a day than it is for a year. Make sense? Okay. So the best thing for you to do, are you guys close, the two of you? Are you the closest of the siblings, would you say? Really? That's not good. Okay, that's better. All right, so you're the closest. So what you want to do is you want to pick the closest. And what you want to do also, let's say the two of you did it together. You lied to your parents. The best thing to do is tell a lie. Then one of you has to kill the other one immediately. No, I'm serious. Because if you do that, it's going to be a short conspiracy, right? As long as if everyone's alive, it lasts forever. Just kill one of them. You don't want to kill her? No, I guess not. Okay, so let's do this then. There's another way to do this. You have to have excellent communication then. If you're not going to kill her, you have to have excellent. Here's why. One of your parents is going to jam you up and they're going to say, hey, what happened? And then you're going to have to be able to communicate everything you said to that parent, to the other co-conspirator, to make sure that they, this is why the first thing we do with two suspects, what do? Separate them. Because we do not want them talking to each other so we can catch them in the lie. Got it? So you have to have excellent communication. Also, you want to pick the sibling you are closest to. Look, I got five, so I have six siblings. Three brothers, three sisters, okay? I think I like maybe two of them, okay? So I'm not gonna pick the other four. I'm gonna pick somebody I like. If this is not the closest person you're to, she's not on your list, sorry. So pick somebody you're close to. Last thing, try to avoid detection. If no one's asking you questions, this can go on forever. But if someone starts asking questions, the harder the questions, the more robust the questions, the more difficult it is to get away with the conspiracy. These are the five things that, as a detective, we unwind on every conspiracy. And we often file charges on conspiracy because we have more than one killer. So I'll add a conspiracy charge. But they're really hard to pull off. And so if I'm already adding the charge, you didn't pull it off. Right, because I'm working the case and we're filing a charge. Now, I only tell you this because if you think that the Christian explanation of the resurrection is a lie, it has to be a part of a larger conspiracy. And if it's part of the larger conspiracy, the question is, does it have these five things? First of all, there's way too many people involved. It's not just James and John and Peter or just over the Titus. No, it's not just the 12. I mean, in the upper room, they're picking from 120. I don't know how many of those people were actual witnesses, but they replaced Judas with Matthias, who qualified because he was a witness. How many of those people were witnesses? Paul says 500 saw the living Christ on the same day in 1 Corinthians 15. So how many people are we talking about here? The number is, if all you told me was, I've got a vast conspiracy involving 500 people, I'm already out. I'm gonna be honest with you. But let's play a game together. You guys like Clue? Ever play Clue? I'm talking old school Clue, okay? Not like the old school Clue. This is the original Clue board, okay? This is the only legitimate Clue game, actually. Whatever you're playing, stupid. This is the original. Okay, now I'm gonna change it a little bit. I'm gonna make the board, the area around where Jesus did his ministry, and I'll put the game pieces on. Here are the disciples. Already too many. But How long did they hold it? Shorter is better. 6 minutes, 6 hours, 6 days, 6 weeks, 6 months, 6 years, 6 decades. You want me to believe that 500 plus people kept conspiracy together without anyone recanting for 6 decades? That's possible, but it's not reasonable. But this is maybe they had, you know, excellent communication. No, they're not in this holy huddle. They're all over the game board, okay? So when they're torturing Thomas, he's got no way to know if Matthew's already given up the ghost. And they're telling these guys as they're torturing, I'm sure, this is, we haven't changed our law enforcement tactics in several centuries. So they're telling this guy that Matthew already gave it up. Dude, Paul's drinking margaritas over here, okay, in Spain. Just go ahead and give it up. No. No way to communicate. You can't Snapchat each other, can't text each other. They're separated by too many miles. Are they under any pressure? This game's got pressure. You guys ever watch 24? Jack Bauer? The original 24 with Jack Bauer? No one ever, this is getting to be an old illustration. I'm almost as like out of date as Mr. Columbo over here, right? No one knows any of our dang illustrations anymore because we're all getting too old for you guys. No one watches these things. But, you know, this guy used to do whatever it took to get the confession. He'd be snapping your fingers off to get your confession. And trust me, they're doing the same thing to these disciples. All that pressure, all those miles apart, too many people. And are there some brothers in this set? Well, there are some close relationships, right? You got, you got Andrew and Peter, James and John. But there's a dude here who's not related to anybody. He wasn't even liked by anybody. He came in dead last. He wasn't part of the discipleship of John the Baptist. You know, those guys, they all said, hey, John said, there's the Lamb of God. I can see why his followers would go. We're waiting for Messiah. And John says, this is the Messiah. We're going. There's a guy out there who was not part of that group. He jumps in last. Nobody even wants him. His name is Matthew. It was Levi originally. This dude writes a pretty early gospel, and he dies without anything in it for him. Why does he give a lick about what happens to these knuckleheads? But he doesn't budge. This is just too easy to break. Is it possible? Anything is possible. I just don't think this one's reasonable. For really no other reason, just the fact that I've worked so many conspiracies and I know how we twist them open. I just don't see it. So I moved off of it. Let me give you one more, and then we'll jump to the end. Maybe they just imagined this. I mean, they wanted it so bad. I'm sure they felt terrible that Jesus was gone. They wanted it so bad. Maybe they just imagined it, right? They hallucinated it. I mean, a lot of these are single sightings. You got Mary. Mary does not want Jesus to be dead. She's by herself. She sees Jesus. No, it's not Jesus. It's the gardener. No, it's Jesus. No, it's the gardener, Mary. You just want it to be Jesus. And you're by yourself, so I can see why you would miss it. No, there's also a couple passages. It sounds like Peter's at least got at least one or two sightings here that are described, or maybe Peter's by himself when he sees Jesus. I can see why he would want it to be true, and he's by himself. He wants it to be true. He's hallucinating it. James, I'm sure, felt bad about seeing, you know, he didn't only deny Jesus, but he sure didn't treat him all that well when he was alive, right? And then he sees Jesus. Well, yeah, you're just imagining this. But then it gets weird, right? Because it gets weird because you got people like the people on the road to Emmaus, where you got more than one person seeing the same thing. Look, if you tell me you know my dream from last night, you're going to freak me out. Because you shouldn't know my... We don't have group dreams. Those things we do as a group, they're called memories, okay? And so if you know my hallucination... And do you think that Paul... He might be by himself, but do you think that Paul wants this to be true? I don't think he does. So it gets weirder as you get the numbers to climb. So you start with the smaller numbers at one, then they kind of build on each one of these. And I just don't, this, really? How do we have these group things? For example, we have three women who see Jesus at the same, are they group dreaming this? And they're able to repeat these details for years. You have seven at the sea. I couldn't even get them all on the same screen, I tried. I got most of them. So the other two are over there. See? Then you got that upper room, right? You got no Judas, you got no Thomas, so you got 10 who see the same thing. How are they doing that? Isn't that weird? 10 people. And then you got the scene where Thomas comes back, so now you have 11 who see the same thing. And that's just, this is a group dream, I guess. And I don't even know how many are in the next scene, because we don't know in some of these scenes if it's just the disciples, 12 rather, or 11 here, or if it's more than that. But at least it is at least the 11. And in some of these, we're not quite sure how many more there would be. We're just not sure. This is my favorite scene of all. By the way, forget about the resurrection for a second. If Jesus just lived his normal life, he did the miracles, and then at the end of his life, he wasn't crucified, he didn't rise from the grave, all he did was ascend into heaven. Would that be enough for you? I think it'd be enough for me, right? I mean, he just you know, ascends into heaven. If I saw that, I think I'd be like, okay, this dude's different, right? I think if you were in this room right now and you saw Jesus ascend into heaven, you would go, oh, dude, I'm in. You want to see it? For those of you who are skeptics and doubters, you want to see it? Let's just count it down. 3, 2, 1. Zoop, there he goes. You've all seen it. So now there should not be a skeptic in the room, right? That's enough for me. And how many do we have here? We have at least 11. And then we have a sighting in which 500 people see, and Paul is bold. That's gutsy to say that, don't you think? You either have to assume that that's a late addition to 1 Corinthians, or you have to assume that Paul is so clever, he never thinks anyone will fact check him. Because to see there are still 500, I can't even count them all. But I'll try to do my best for you. So I got that many, and then I just had to add a few, like that's it. Now I got them all. Now look, if this is just a hallucination, it's not that difficult to fact check this, right? Because if you have imagined seeing Jesus, then I can go back to the tomb and there should be a body in the tomb. If there's not a body in the tomb, then now I'm back to conspiracy theory, and you already know why I reject conspiracy theory. And this is why I see when Peter says, look, we're not making this stuff up. This is not some clever tale. We just happen to see it with our own eyes. That seems reasonable. There's still a couple more to go through. I'm going to try to go through one more real fast, okay? Real fast. I love it when I make Frank Turek late because he gets so, so mad. It's awesome. Maybe these are just, I'm going to skip a couple here. I'll skip that one. I'll skip that one. I'll send those to you in a video. Let's go to this one down here. They're distorted. Maybe this is just a late legend. The problem with the late legend theory is it has to be two things to be a late legend. It has to be late and a legend. I don't think it's either. But I can see why you might think the story of Jesus, maybe the first story of Jesus, is the simple preaching rabbi who later, you know, the mythology begins to grow and the story is distorted over time, and 300 years later we now have the Christ of Christianity. We go from the Jesus of history to the Christ of Christianity because it's been distorted over time. That's a lot of time to change the story. Something similar happens in criminal trials where I have a crime scene and I have a courtroom. I'll put a piece of evidence in the crime scene. You see that bullet casing? I'm going to bring that into trial 30 years later. I'm going to tell you that on that bullet casing that I now have in trial, there is an extractor pin mark where the extractor pin from a semi-automatic handgun will pull the casing out to advance the next round, okay? And that extractor pin matches the extractor pin mark on this casing, and that extractor pin happens to belong to the defendant's gun. Therefore, that mark on that casing is good evidence that my defendant did this crime. I think you could easily say, well, how do I know that you didn't pull this out of property 10 years after the fact and etch in the extractor pin mark on the casing? So now it's been altered. The people who followed you had no idea it had been altered. At the crime lab, they worked it like it was legitimate evidence. Then I pick it up as a cold case detective, and I have no idea that it's been tampered with and that this casing I have today is nothing like the casing we started with. Couldn't the same kind of thing happen at the bottom? Where I have some version of Jesus, but by the time I get it to the council, this is the Council of Laodicea, by the time I get it this far in history, that it has been changed in some way that's significant. And I've had years to do it, over and over and over again, until the person who represents the final manuscript in this council is like me, has no idea that this Jesus has been changed so dramatically. Well, here's how we determine if this happens in a criminal trial. We simply asked the question, back in 1980 when this was going on, was there an officer who showed up at the scene who took a picture of that casing? Do you guys know what a Polaroid is? Okay, I'm not gonna test you on Polaroids, but no time for that. But we wanna know, is there a detective or an officer at the scene who either took a picture or he wrote a comprehensive supplemental report in which he describes the extractor pin mark? That would be helpful. Now, he's going to give it to somebody, like my dad in those days. My dad would take another Polaroid. He would call it an investigative Polaroid because we had to wait for 35mm film to come back, take 2 weeks. Can't work a homicide quickly if you have to wait 2 weeks for the pictures, right? So he'd take his own picture, write his own report. He'd bring it to the crime lab. They're taking much more advanced pictures, writing their own reports. I come years later, I write a report about what I pick up. I've got report after report after report, picture after picture after picture, connecting the past to the present. These are like links in a chain. This is why in criminal trials we call this the chain of custody. I have to show the chain of custody for every significant piece of evidence. Who touched it? Who photographed it? Who documented it? Who handled it? Is there a chain of custody of sorts for the New Testament? Actually, there is. I'll show you one. So here's our crime scene. Here's our courtroom. First officer at the crime scene who takes a picture of Jesus. We'll just start with John. So the question is, John said something about Jesus, but how do I know what was in that original? How do I know what he would have said since I don't have the original anymore? Well, the question is, who are the next links in his chain? Who did John give this information to on a personal basis? Well, he had three personal students. These students of John received from John information about Jesus. We can now compare what they say about Jesus to what John said about Jesus to see if the story has changed. Did they describe Jesus as miraculously as John does? Did they describe Jesus being born of a virgin, for example? You know, John doesn't even mention the virgin birth. But they were his students. John would have known about that. Did they mention it? Now, it turns out we happen to have documents because these leaders became leaders. These folks became leaders in the local churches. They wrote to local congregations. And we have surviving manuscripts. Even the most redacted surviving manuscripts we can look at to see what, do they match John? Does Ignatius match John? Does Polycarp match Ignatius? We don't have anything from Papias. We just have some being quoted from Eusebius. But we do have documents from Polycarp, at least one letter. So the question is, do these letters match each other, or do they, not in terms of word for word, I'm talking about the concepts being mentioned. Is Jesus less miraculous? Of course, they had a student named Irenaeus. Two of them did, Polycarp and Ignatius. Irenaeus is going to give us tons of data that we can read. This is all in our book, but you can take a look at it. I want to know, is his description of Jesus different than the second links in the chain? He's the third link. Fourth link is Hippolytus. I cannot find a student of Hippolytus, though, that I feel confident about. Origen actually watched one message from Hippolytus, but I wouldn't call him a student, so I'm going to stop it right there. And by the way, although I only have a chain of custody here that gets me this far, if the first link in the chain, outside the chain, Ignatius, matches what we have today, we're really okay. Now, there are other chains of custody, and I talk about these, one from Paul through Tatian, and one from Peter all the way through to Eusebius. These are the masters and students heel to toe in history. So the question is, if you lost all of the New Testament, you don't have it, it's been destroyed, and all you have are the first students of the eyewitnesses, what would you know about Jesus? You'd know everything you know now, because nothing's changed. Started early, repeated early, and never changed. And if you're not late and not legendary, you cannot be a late legend. So I moved off this as an explanation. And that left me with one explanation. And it happens to be your explanation. Your explanation that this is just an accurate report of what happened to Jesus. Now, I will grant you that explanation you guys offer, it is the most thorough and robust explanation for those four pieces of evidence we just started with, right? I mean, it does describe these best, but I would have told you as an atheist, not happening for me. And the reason why it's not happening for me is you want me to believe that the most reasonable explanation for the resurrection is a supernatural event called the resurrection. No, there's no way. This explanation requires me to believe in something I reject. But wait a minute, Jim, isn't this a real question? The real question is, are supernatural events like the resurrection ever candidates for the most reasonable explanation? And I would have said no. They are never the most reasonable candidate because I reject the supernatural. No, Jim, stop. That's what we're trying to discover. I get it. You don't think that, but we're trying to discover if this is reasonable, if a supernatural event is reasonable. You can't start off by saying no. You haven't investigated it yet. Suspend your skepticism long enough to investigate it. Because I'll tell you what happens. If you say, no, I don't believe in the supernatural, well, then I can show you a piece of evidence. You will find a way to jump over it because you don't believe in the supernatural. Well, I can show you how early they, I can show up in their quote, don't care, don't believe in supernatural stuff. Well, I can show you how they're supported by archaeology, like what Titus did two nights ago? Don't care, don't believe in supernatural stuff. And no matter what I show you, you will find a way to jump over it. And the reason why you're jumping over this and ending up right here with supernaturalism is not reasonable is because that's where you started. And you don't want to budge. You're committed to this. That is not a good way to do an investigation. Just to say, I don't care, I don't want to look at anything because I've already decided what is true. There's a reason why I started this entire talk with this nightstand. If you think you know the answer before you start, you don't move. Not only do you not move, you don't even look any further. You stop looking because you think you know the answer. So when it comes down to it, there's only two possibilities here. Either Jesus rose from the dead or he didn't. Now, if you just said, Jim, you want me to consider this, that he rose from the dead? I have to open up my mind to all kinds of explanations then, even supernatural. No, I don't do that because I reject supernatural explanations. That was a roadblock for me. But if I went back to just my naturalistic explanations, none of these work. They don't. I didn't care. I'd find a way to jump over those, go around those, dig under those, because I was committed to getting over here. And I didn't care that none of this stuff worked. Let's take a look for a second. Which of these two paths is least encumbered? Like, duh, right? I got six obstacles. And there's only one on this side. And check it out. I put it there. This does not have to be here. I could ease. This is my presuppositional bias. I could easily take it down. Oh, no, don't want to take it down. But if you take it down, it's really clear, which is easier. Nope, don't care. Don't want to take it down. Well, Jim, that's about you. If you take it down, everything opens up, and now you have a clear path with the least number of problems. Look, if there is a God who's powerful enough to create the entire universe from nothing, that kind of God has the ability to do all kinds of lesser miracles. And I was somebody who believed in Big Bang cosmology, so I already agreed. Something caused the universe to come into existence from nothing. If that something happens to be personal, then this resurrection stuff was small potatoes. I just had to realize that the thing that was standing between me and the cross was me and my bias. So I started to take those down. Now I'm going to send you all this material from our website at coldcasechristianity.com. We have a phone app. So if you have a question, just download the phone app. I answer questions every morning on the phone app before I do anything else. So I'll answer your questions tomorrow on the phone app. And we have a show on NRB TV where we talk about this, and we have a YouTube channel also where you can watch these videos. But I'm going to send you this stuff, and here's how I'm going to send it to you. You're going to text me the word detective. I know this is a bad number. It's got a lot of sixes in it. You Christians are freaked out about sixes. But I didn't pick this number. It's 66866. Just text that number, and you're going to text to that number one word, the word detective, and then I'm going to send you all this stuff tonight. You'll have everything to be able to make the case for Christianity, and plus the rest of this talk. Make sense? Let's pray real quickly, and then I'll introduce Frank. Thank you, Father, for opportunities to talk about truth, to examine truth in a way that maybe is new. And just help us to use what we learned here this week, what we've learned here with all of these speakers, to have the kind of confidence that allows us to both, number one, stand tall, and number two, share the truth with others. We pray this in the name of your precious son, Jesus. And everyone here says, amen. Thanks, guys.